You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello everyone, welcome to yet another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson. Today is Wednesday, September 23rd, 2020. Today I've entitled this, actually I wrote this a few months ago, Piece It Together, actually, in a paper that's far from being publishable. But it's one of the fundamental sorts, like the nominalist issue. The last few weeks, this is more the psychological and sociological element. And the title, the temporary title I gave it is "How Can We Use the Term Freedom and Not Sound Like Hackneyed Amateurs?" And I could say the same for things like individualism. As I've said for several decades, the concept of the individual is a myth. It's a myth of industrialization. And of course, nominalism is focused entirely around the individual. And so really it has its roots in the Protestant Reformation, in the Renaissance, which of course ended in total destruction, where Protestantism now actually has no theology, has no church, really has no function at all except as a prop to the modern left. But a word like individual, like freedom, like love, in postmodern English, these terms have no meaning. At best, it's idiosyncratic. And I guess really what it comes down to, it has something to do with someone's demand to no longer be under some moral code or system of rules. So to use a word in a sentence, you could yell something like, "We demand freedom." And it's a stupid and meaningless phrase, because the question is freedom to do what? But the minute that question is asked, you're already in trouble. Freedom of speech is wonderful until you ask, what are you going to use it for? But if someone answers you with an abstraction, you know they're hiding something. So if someone were to answer that question by saying something like, freedom to live our own lives, you realize they're hiding something. And then you say, well, what would that entail? Usually at that point in the conversation, they get irritated for the same reason, and they're hiding. They're hiding what they want under a meaningless slogan. But in postmodernity, abstract freedom can be a disaster. The United States today is a large processing plant for the production of beastly semi-humans designed to purchase commodities made by others, very, very far away, working for slave wages, while themselves, of course, working for slave wages, but having limited credit to make it seem like they have more money than they really do. This automaton is then told that their condition is the ultimate manifestation of freedom. And not only that, that is historical inevitability. So pumped full of drugs, self-hate, chimerical images, sophistical ideologies, the American is shepherded through life by a pantheon of celebrities creating a dream world. This is the inverted universe, the invented universe within which the mass man cognitively lives. The average American doesn't even have the vocabulary to describe his condition, let alone fight it. And very possibly, the people who might fight it will make something even worse. There is no positivist doctrine. Man, of course, has a hypothetical capacity for free will, but freedom requires a tremendous amount of work and discipline. In the non-arbitrary sense, it's not something you're born with. Man is born helpless and absolutely dependent. Freedom comes only through suffering and struggle with yourself, society, or both. But if you insist on using terms like, you know, tyranny or authoritarianism, well, why do they exist in the first place? Well, there has to be an advanced amount of social decay in order for any kind of irrational system to develop. So the brutalization of Europe's population after World War I and elsewhere are means whereby the morals of the population can be shredded. War is a common cause for oppressive systems because of the dislocation it causes. So works of literature like Antigone or even Dr. Zhivago, war wipes out previous conceptions of life. I'm not entirely sure how modernity survived World War I, let alone World War II, but once the moral order is shattered, systems can arise based on revolutionary morals or no morals at all. But since man is distorted already, the new system can be based on this. But once these regimes are created, and peace is restored, we can be awoken in a very sharp way. The Soviet system created an army of dissidents who were forced to reconsider their history and how it helped adapt themselves against the present system. Like evil itself, oppression is part of a broader whole. It wipes the slate clean so as to rebuild social life once it begins to weaken. If the system is truly oppressive, it usually falls under its own irrationality. They have a tendency not to last. The challenge is to rebuild, but rebuilding comes first from resistance. But real oppression creates a different personality. The real is either accepted or negated. There's no third option. Solzhenitsyn claimed that very few people actually believed in the USSR. That's an ideological concept. They were opportunists who mouthed the slogan for the sake of promotion. Even in the church, they saw the USSR as a needed cleansing, a form of rebirth, not evil in itself. Since it required to remake man different than it was before, suffering is required for real knowledge. In fact, suffering is needed for anything of value to be produced. Suddenly, you can't take old institutions for granted, so the pain itself forces you to get to the root of them. Times of stress are some of the most creative, both socially and personally. But man's never determined by institutions. There is a structure to cognition that rejects any system that makes war on nature. The family, the corporation, the farm, whatever it is, these are all based on natural, not conventional, demands. Oppression insists that all is subject to political analysis, which means all is subject to regimentation. You hear sometimes people talk about the desire to be independent as individuals. They hate the idea of being dependent on something. And I tend to chuckle at these people and I say, well, you don't deliver your own mail, do you? Do you police your own streets? How about the language that you use? You create that? The job you have, the currency that you use, the banking system. In fact, everything that you have and see, you didn't create. So don't talk to me about being independent of anything, because that is impossible in every way. You are utterly dependent. But beyond that, and there's nothing wrong with that. That's simply what human beings are. Human beings, to quote Alistair MacIntyre, who I have an entire book criticizing, are rational, dependent animals. When people use words like independence, referring to themselves, they're referring to a specific question that they have, a moral rule that they want to break. And independence gives them somehow this abstract justification for something very concrete. Dependence is what a human being is. A human being is a dependent animal. Now, for many decades, I've quoted Plato as the main authority here, but his entire corpus is based in living under a regime that was, given the standards of the time, oppressive and therefore unstable and absurd. Because it was like that, the forms or archetypes were seen as divorced from society entirely. We live in a society like that, where the archetypes are nowhere to be found. But we see them clearly because society in its absurdity forces the mind away from it. The archetypes can be seen when they've been banished from the city. Man thinks he can create his own happiness, which is almost never the case. Reaching to the forms became the sole goal of philosophy. Philosophy was born out of oppression as a form of resistance, which means that real philosophers end up dead on the margins of society or in prison, not tenured professionals with six-figure salaries. Philosophy, by definition, can't be done by such people. It can be destroyed by them, however. So when these two entities converge, this happens. The disconnection of justice and life can lead to one of two things, either opportunistic acceptance or active rebellion. Only a tiny proportion of the population choose the latter, while the rest, when the war is over, will tell you that they've been with you the whole time. But it's not a temporary inconvenience. Americans define oppression as a temporary inconvenience. Rather, it's a distortion of something good. The political becomes everything. Capital rules all. Social sanction forces us to be silent. Stagnation leads to bureaucratization. Law is taken as an end in itself, as a set of formal rules, and so on. That's the nature of actual oppression. It has nothing to do with the inability to live your own life, since there is no such entity. Power, science, economics is seen as self-sufficient, and law is something made rather than discovered. All of these are distortions of something good. One aspect of life, like the economic or the scientific, comes to dominate everything else. Today, of course, oppression need not come from the state. The state isn't some abstraction, but is made up of real flesh and blood people's real agendas. In postmodern America, the state is largely privatized, living far beyond its means, unable to enforce any increase in taxes, assuming that will lead to greater revenues anyway. The system has privatized its state functions to the lowest bidder. It's like buying offices in old France or the old Ottoman Empire to the French crown without having recourse to direct taxation like the modern state does. Raise cash by selling offices and titles. On the one hand, the state had loyal and wealthy servitors. On the other, the buyer's office would have no meaning outside the royal state. It was unstable, but only for the short term, but it's been repeated over and over again using different terms. But as Solzhenitsyn and many others will say, Dostoevsky, Gogol, the whole gamut of them, oppression comes down to being a slave to desire. This is a worse form of oppression, because you can't run from yourself. Asceticism is rebellion against this. However, liberal democracy, the system we live under, has no room for asceticism. It's a society based entirely on consumption. Therefore, asceticism is pure heresy. Those suffering from internal oppression redefine the word in purely political terms. This way they avoid cognitive dissonance. It doesn't force us to be loyal to it, but eventually we either accept it, which means mental death, or to battle against it, which could also lead to mental death, but it also lays open the way to incredible insight and at least courage. Hegel, as always, as well as Plato, is the best theorist on freedom in the non-arbitrary sense. Like everything, freedom is historical and is not intrinsic to human nature in the abstract. Freedom in the abstract is infinite in Hegel's system, precisely because it's meaningless. It doesn't refer to any action in particular or even actions at all. Hegel argues that the person is the only thing capable of freedom, not the ego. The ego, the individual, the person, those are three separate things. A person, by definition, has to be a concrete aspect of the social whole that's formed by it. Now, it's a matter of the ego. Freedom can't work in any society. It's the negation of any society. Freedom exists in a dialectical relationship with necessity, and the two always condition one another. So nations are organized in such a way that necessity, that is, objective human needs, things that we need to survive and function, that's not a matter of freedom, of course, implying as it does that individuals are subject to forces over which they have no control, and which constrain their actions even against their own wills. To work in freedom possibly work, then. It doesn't exist at the fundamentals, since our needs are all the same. It's a matter of means. Basic needs are a matter of necessity, as well as the means whereby these things are met. Men are in a condition of interdependence without which no need whatsoever can be met. It's not possible in modern society to satisfy one's needs without entering into the broader division of labor, the system of needs, as Hegel would say. And this is true of any society. So far, I'm not seeing where any kind of individualism could possibly ever exist. Because there is nothing that, no relationship you can have where you are by yourself. Even Grizzly Adams used techniques and education and knowledge that he learned outside of the forest. As I've said many times before, even arguing, to argue that you're independent, an individual, requires you to use logic and language and theory that, of course, you had no part in creating. So even in defending your position, it's an automatic contradiction. When Plato called this the city of pigs in the Republic, a system of basic production that comes into existence with particular individuals who enter into it. That's as far as modern liberal theory goes. But it rises spontaneously in that no one has organized it specifically and there's no plan for it. But Hegel alludes to this element by insisting that the individual enters civil society as someone who makes their own particular will into the end of his activity, which is what modern individualism claims. So that in civil society, the principle of self-interest then is posited. In my case, I was born in a society that was ruled by passion, ego, class, external appearance, and positivism. It's easy to go along with it. Many of us have seen too much evil among even especially those we considered successful. But I also saw that most people were irrational, pursuing self-interest rather than the truth. That took a while to concept that took a while to digest. So we're forced to lead a very different kind of a life. I was affected by it all, of course, and may never get rid of its effects entirely. But these are in a sense good because it forces people like me to reconsider everything, including the definition of success. This is what forced me to study theory. The only way I could only criticize this society is by studying others. Now, practical restraints is something that you can see everywhere. It exists regardless of the nature of the system. What I'm talking about with Hegel is that he sees these as the conditions of human freedom, in the sense that people get used to restraining their immediate desires and inclinations, which allows us to gain some control over these same desires. Therefore, you have to adopt a more universal view as a condition of being able to recognize the validity of laws and institutions that reflect the notion that the system of needs can't be negotiated away. In other words, freedom is not the absence of restraint. It's not the case that individuals are subject to a purely external form of necessity, as modern liberalism would think. Practical constraint is inherent to human nature, of course. Freedom is a lot like love in this respect. People may have a right to speak. People also have a right to shut up, depending on the circumstances. But Hegel first considers people who obey the laws only because they recognize that a life of lawlessness would frustrate their own purposes. They obey the laws because if everyone did, they couldn't pursue their self-interest. These people see the state as a necessary evil. Now, if they could get away with anarchy, they'd follow that, so long as their property was protected. In other words, they conceive of living in a political society as a contingent matter, as liberalism teaches, though much here depends on how seriously they take this to be. This is where Western societies begin to break down, because society is no longer a natural object. On the other hand, Hegel regards practical constraint as the foundation of freedom rather than something to be overcome. It generates a condition of interdependence, which not only predates the person, but also ultimately requires the rule of law, the existence of a state, for its effective functioning. So when Hegel considers the sort of individuals who think of themselves as living in a political society as a matter of necessity, solely with respect to the satisfaction of their needs, he has to be taken to have in mind an attitude which is a fake one. It consists in a sense, having a choice in the matter, however vague that might be. There's no choice, and there never could be. Constraint and freedom are two sides of the same coin. But of course, civil society or individualism creates classes, and they come to see freedom differently. So the rich man, by virtue of his wealth, the power it brings him, comes to think of himself as free of the constraints imposed by others, on others by the condition of interdependence which underlies civil society. This is because his wealth appears to allow the rich to do whatever they want and to dominate others who are made to act in accordance with his personal ends, as if they're universal ones. Given the apparent independence of others, which he enjoys as virtue of his wealth, the rich individual has no need to be a member of a form of association like the corporation or the modern guild. The powerful is free of the constraints which membership of such an association would impose. When this claim is taken in conjunction with what Hegel says about the class that suffers dependence and want, he implies that the extent to which one experiences an absence of constraint in modern society will be proportional to the amount of economic power that one enjoys. Still, The rich capitalist is not really free. Not the condition of interdependence and the practical constraints that it imposes on the human will. When wealth and power that he enjoys are themselves the result of the workings of economic laws governing market relations that develop on the basis of this condition of interdependence. In other words, his freedom is an illusory one. Everything that he has is a result of other people, whether it be people who work for him, the currency that he uses, the weaponry that his security guards have, the fact that he depends on a whole network of other people in order for him to function for 2 minutes. Well, he can't buy a yacht, and yes, unless there's an entire economic system that knows how to make them and protect them from others. So on the one hand, the power enjoyed by the capitalist is certainly something real and may adequately explain his subjective experience of the absence of constraint. But on the other, it is possible to think of him as someone from whom the necessity which underlies civil society nevertheless remains concealed. You know, a prison remains a prison, even if it's paved in silver. It remains a prison nonetheless. It remains a prison even if you don't know it's a prison. So the wealthy may be a beneficiary of the economic system. He can only act in accordance with the system's laws, or at least to make sure that they operate in his favor. He doesn't make them, and he can't fully determine their particular outcomes, which are, after all, determined by countless arbitrary choices made by others. But the capitalist may maybe attempt to make sure in associating with others that the dice are firmly loaded in his favor, but his actions remain subject to necessity. Even St. John Chrysostom in the ancient world, well, that early medieval ancient world, he makes a claim that the wealthy are far less free than others because their condition is very contingent. One lawsuit, one corrupt judge, one audit, or even a riot can bring it all down, or even a war can bring it all down. So by introducing the idea of subjective freedom in the philosophy of right, and then stressing the notion of necessity in his theory of civil society, Hegel goes a long way towards comprehending the notion of freedom. He develops his accounts of abstract right and morality, a conception of modern individuals as agents capable of exercising choice and determining, acting in accordance with what they think their notion of the good is. Wherever that comes from is another matter. It's very rare that anyone does a pro-con list as to what they think good acts are, or what right is, what justice is. Usually these are things that either come from pure self-interest or are something just inherited from the world around them. Now, they still live in a world of absolute necessity, as do we all. In their case, though, it's much harder to see. His liberalism goes far out of its way to conceal the dependency which would undermine its very existence. So you can emphasize the concept of freedom while ignoring that of necessity, and it threatens to provide a totally one-sided account. But that's why it's to be rejected as absurd. One of the main virtues of Hegel's account of civil society in the philosophy of right is the way in which it reveals the necessity that underlies the modern form of ethical life. I'm going to think of it this way. Someone like Alexander Dugin makes this, I think, a bit more understandable. And as someone who I've been reading and translating for a long time, Dugin's one of these people that people claim to know about. They quote him all the time. They've never read him, since the overwhelming majority of his stuff has not been translated into English. He was never an advisor to the Russian president. He had never had any official capacity. Someone invented that, and people take it as true. But he talks about liberalism in the individualist sense, the kind of the modern sense, as a deliberate deception, as I've already stated. So Plato realized that when ideas exist in their pure form, they're not subject to entropy. But the minute they start to be realized, they immediately undergo decomposition. Dugin says this. He goes, "It's very important to pay attention to the fact that projects are very important to a person in principle. Every morning we start by making a plan for the day, then for the week, then for the rest of our lives. But this is utopian. What we want to do is not yet. To a large extent, utopia absorbs all thoughts, all dreams, all fantasies about the new. The habitual in utopia and our plans is considered as something routine, unprincipled, unimportant. Utopian descriptions emphasize something new, unexpected, unusual, which is not in common practice. Many philosophers have noted that the material person, largely engaged in satisfying its carnal needs only, by and large does not consider himself to be anything other than being largely an animal. Man categorically opposes his thought. This thought, utopia, is the only thing that distinguishes man from the animal life. The animal has no utopia. It agrees with the conditions in which it is. Man does not. As far as liberalism is concerned, he says, liberalism is a disgusting, misanthropic, vile teaching. It is disgusting in theory and in practice. If we knew what was behind the beautiful foreign word liberalism, you would have recoiled, horrified, rushed to run away from it as soon as possible and as far as possible. It's time to call a spade, and we have been confused for too long. That makes sense, given what the ideology did in the 1990s. But, of course, liberalism in Russian is roughly the same as in English, because it is a foreign word, and it's connected to the idea of freedom. It tends to be associated with negative freedom, which is what we called, I said before, as abstract freedom. Someone like John Stuart Mill is what Hegel was really poking fun at. And according to Mill, there are two freedoms. Freedom is liberty, and freedom is the lack of constraint. Liberty and autonomy are the same thing, but they're totally different from the lack of constraint. Liberty is a concept from which the term liberalism originated, but that's where it begins to break down. Liberty is strictly negative freedom. Freedom from things. Concept that all first-year students in political science know. But that's freedom as such in his mind. The task of the liberals to free themselves from socio-political, religious, or even class traditions and obligations. Freedom from is the individual is a freedom of an individual from society, from all social connections, dependencies, and assessments. Liberalism insists that the measure of all things is the commercial individual. He is a meaning and terminus of life. It's always been an economic matter. It's always a mercenary individual. Hegel says this in the notion of civil society. Abstract liberty really comes down to the commercial ego. So all legal, administrative, moral, religious, and social restrictions have to be lifted from the commercial life. Its whims, its interests, calculations become the new value system. But when it comes to morals, all of a sudden the vaunted scientific exactitude of the modern world goes out the window. The minute human behavior is studied, all of a sudden normality goes out the window. And this is why. There were no more religious and moral norms. However, the quantitative world had to be precise and exact. It was a chaotic game of merchants without a homeland, faith, ethics, or culture. The invisible hand of the market, which directs the process towards a cherished goal, to make the powerful, the men who gain power through strength, power through cash. They can sleep better at night knowing that they are in tune with the invisible hand. But the negation is concrete. The so-called freedom of liberalism is to be freed from anything tangible and real. But of course, we're limited by many things. And the process of getting rid of these barriers, and social obligations, is completely transparent. Lower taxes, fewer laws, fewer agencies. But the tricky question is, what do we need this kind of freedom? From what? Or for what? Negative freedom is one thing, but it still can't tell us for what. Even a concern with money only goes so far. Freedom for, on the other hand, what are we doing with this liberty, is a totally empty and vapid concept. And this is why people like Mill and the entire Western liberal tradition, which apparently everyone's supposed to agree with, has no answer to the question. Conservatives are conservative liberals, and liberals are liberal liberals. They're identical in their foundation. Freedom for requires higher purpose and a more fundamental understanding of the human person. Liberalism thrives on its shallow idea of society, or even the rejection of society as such. Questions like, what is the positive meaning of life? They can't answer the question, let alone answer it. Why does a person work at all? Why does a person love or create? Why to direct any kind of energy? Freedom 4 is a complete destruction of liberalism. It throws it into darkness. Its philosophical questioning throws us completely, with the liberal anyway, it's thrown into a quandary. There's a risk, there's a madness, a challenge. Liberalism fails even at the level of theory. So Dugin writes, when he's talking about John Stuart Mill and the whole so-called tradition in the first place, he says, John Stuart Mill pales in front of this question. He's overwhelmed by the terrifying being opening of positive freedom. He doesn't know what to do with this. He folds, he hides, he moves away from the answer. Here on the horizon of European philosophy appears a lean German professor of Slavic origin. Thin yellow fingers deftly and a little squeamishly grab the Englishman by the earlobe of the Puritan ear. Friedrich Nietzsche, the brilliant, merciless, fatal, like the wind of the desert, do you call yourself free? I want to hear your dominant thought, not that you have thrown off the yoke. You have the right to throw off the yoke off yourself. There are not a few who lost their last value when they were freed from their slavery. Free from what? This is the issue. And none of this suggests that I have any interest in defending Nietzsche, but he is very misunderstood. Some of you remember I did my master's thesis on Nietzsche and Hegel, precisely in this respect. He's talking, of course, of bourgeois freedom, bourgeois Christianity, having nothing to do with the real foundation of those terms. Mere freedom of constraint, or freedom from constraint, has no relation to freedom at all. It's a meaningless concept. Mere freedom from restraint doesn't mean a thing, because it doesn't tell us what we're going to do, what we're going to do with it. Freedom from, so to speak, is the aspiration of the slave. The slave morality only sees freedom from. Freedom for is a different matter altogether. So liberalism really is a platform, as Dugin would say, for freaks and rogues who seek to legally preserve the loot, the stolen, the expropriated. Its sole purpose, when you have a political system which is dedicated to purely negative freedom, which ultimately is abstract freedom, as Hegel would say, it exists only for one purpose, and that is for the sake of commercial gain. And some of these libertarian types, some of the your typical Republican who uses words like this, really doesn't understand the foundation of it. They'll ignorantly quote Friedrich Hayek, and having no idea what he actually wrote on the topic, when he wrote Individualism, True and False. This is what Hayek actually has to say about it. I could give no better illustration of the prevailing confusion about the meaning of individualism than the fact that the man who seems to be one of the greatest representatives of true individualism, Edmund Burke, is commonly and rightly represented as the main opponent of so-called individualism, of Rousseau, whose theories he feared would rapidly dissolve the commonwealth into the dust and powder of individuality. The term individualism itself was first introduced into the English language through translations of one of the works of another great representative of true individualism, de Tocqueville, who uses it in Democracy in America to describe an attitude which he deplores and rejects. But there's no doubt that both Burke and de Tocqueville stand in all essentials close to Adam Smith, who no one will deny the title of an individualist. That the individualism to which they are opposed is something altogether different from that of Adam Smith. Well, there's positives and negatives here. Rousseau did not believe in individualism in any modern sense of the term. He didn't believe in modernity. For one thing, that individualism in the sense that we use the term is something de Tocqueville had condemned. Adam Smith, being a utilitarian, didn't focus on the individual at all. A utilitarian doesn't have a foundation except what's useful, what works, whether it's the individual or not. So even Hayek here is difficult to agree with. But what he's saying is that the abstract individualism that Hegel's talking about, and that we all were born and raised in believing, is fraudulent. And one of the dumber people out there who has a reputation as somewhat of a scholar, a psychiatrist, Lyle Rosseter. I don't know if he pronounces it as a Frenchman, I don't really care, but you're going from one field to another is a terrible idea. Rosseter probably be the first one to tell someone who's talking about psychiatry without being a psychiatrist that he should stay in his lane, but he has no problem writing a book on political theory, despite having no background in the field. And it shows. If someone can't talk about psychiatry without being a psychiatrist, then he should shut up when he talks about political theory, which is easily just as technical, far more so, and far older than modern psychiatry. Is a few centuries old. Political philosophy is as old as humanity. And this is what this man actually writes and takes seriously. He says, individualism insists that an individual's freedom to live as he chooses may not be subordinated to any collective-based rules beyond those essential to secure social order and equal liberty for all individuals. It insists further that in order to preserve the agency, autonomy, and sovereignty of the individual, official policy decisions must first give importance to the individual, not to a group, and especially not to a government. The only legitimate function of government is to foster the lives of citizens by protecting their rights as individuals, not as members of a class or group. No collective cause, he repeats for the third time, should be allowed to override the rights, override those rights. Individualism opposes any conception of the state or the collective as primary in value over the individual. In particular, it opposes any notion that the individual exists for the good of the state. This is why psychiatrists shouldn't write works of political theory. Really, they shouldn't write works of psychiatry either, but certainly they fail in this respect. He starts off with dishonest distinctions, that there's only an individual, which of course is a very modern conception, and a collective. There's no in between. There's no community, which is not in between, actually, but is a function of the person, not the ego. A collective only exists when you forcibly bring egos together who have no natural connection. Then he refers to things like autonomy as if that's the same thing as freedom. He uses words like sovereignty without defining it, having no idea what these terms mean. And of course, the assumption here is that all individuals are the same. And I'm not really sure where the idea of protecting this autonomy and sovereignty comes from, if not a communal decision. I'm not entirely sure where this kind of ideological point of view would come from if it was strictly based on individuals. If individuals are going to be pursuing their self-interest, then one that takes over the levers of state power should do all they can to crush their opposition. If that's not the case, and somehow everyone has this abstract right, which he never explains where it comes from, or even what it is, that individuals have these abstract rights, that he's not going to talk about individuals anymore. Now he's talking about groups, he's talking about states, he's talking about collective properties, which he denies exists. The entire thing, I mean, when you read it for the first time and you don't know anything, it sounds vaguely plausible until you think about it for 5 seconds and realize, even using words like legitimate function, notions of legitimacy are not individual concerns. If self-interest is all that matters, then there is no concept of legitimacy. There is no concept of classes or groups. And this is the same man who condemns moral relativism, as if that's somehow different from individualism. It's not uncommon for amateur newcomers to this field to say that conservatives believe in limited government, individualism, and capitalism, apparently unaware that these are revolutionary doctrines of the Enlightenment. Conservatism came into existence to fight these doctrines. Another error made above is the inability to distinguish between communities and collectives. As I said before, they have absolutely nothing in common. The notion that the individual is the ego, the center of all things, it's a very definition of social decay, can only come from an American at the end of a dying empire. They're often surprised to know that writers who they think are individualists are nothing of the kind, like Hayek, for that matter. They even refer to Adam Smith, having no idea what a utilitarian is. The individual is a mythical creature of the post-industrial age. An individual is an abstraction. He possesses nothing. He has no ideas, language, logic, or politics, since they are all communal possessions. So I really wish that he would stay out of my field. On the other hand, it's not uncommon, especially amongst libertarians and other, you know, weirdo Republicans. But of course, the one thing that these people seem to share is that individuals are all the same. They have to be, if they're all to be treated equally as individuals. But this is far from the case. They even go so far as to claim that the Founding Fathers, who they know zero about, don't realize that you really can't use a collective word like Founding Fathers and say all disagree with each other on pretty much everything, especially the Constitution. And the majority of them actually rejected the Constitution. Had no conception of this bizarre abstraction of the individual. John Adams wrote to Thomas Jefferson, and of course, you know, they kept up this rivalry, but a personal friendship throughout their lives. But John Adams says this. He said, "The natural aristocracy I consider as the most precious gifts of nature for the instruction, the trust, and government of society. It would have been inconsistent in creation to have formed a man for the social state and not to have provided virtue and wisdom enough to manage the concerns of society." They would not even say that the form of government is the best which provides the most effectually for the pure selection of these natural aristoi into the offices of government. The artificial aristocracy is a mischievous ingredient in government, and provision should be made to prevent its ascendancy. What is the best provision? You and I differ. If we differ as rational friends using the free exercise of our own reason, mutually indulging its errors. You think it best to put the pseudo-aristoi in a separate chamber of legislation where they may be hindered from doing mischief by their coordinate branches, and where also they may be a protection to wealth against the agrarian and plundering enterprises of the majority of the people. I think to give them power to prevent them from doing mischief is arming them for it, and increasing instead of remedying the evil. I think its best remedy here is exactly that provided by our constitutions to leave the citizens the free election and separation of the aristoi from the pseudo-aristoi. But the wheat from the chaff in general, they will elect the good and the wise. In some instances, wealth may corrupt and birth blind them, but not in sufficient degree to endanger the society. Now, what is he talking about? Usually, modern Americans reading that have no idea what they're looking at, don't know what words like aristoi mean. Keep in mind here that the people, of course, is never an abstraction, is a very small class. The body of citizens and the mass of citizens were two very, and the mass of people, I should say, are two very different things. Roughly 4% of the public back then was considered free and hence could vote, which, in my opinion, is perfectly rational. But neither Adams nor Jefferson believed that the people, as some abstraction, referring to everybody, was capable of anything but destruction, as he says. The individual was a horrid manifestation, which would later be called the mass. Then Adams writes elsewhere, he says, "When I consider the weakness, the folly, the pride, the vanity, the selfishness, the artifice, the low craft and mean cunning, the want of principle, the avarice, the unbounded ambition, the unfair cruelty of the majority of those in all nations who are allowed an aristocratic influence, on the other hand, the stupidity in which the more numerous multitude not only become their dupes, but even love to be taken in by their tricks, I feel a stronger disposition to weep at their destiny than to laugh at their folly." He's talking about two different groups of people here, both equally degenerate. And this is in a far healthier society. The pseudo-aristoi, of course, are those like today, the multimillionaires, those, you know, the Senate was supposed to be the aristocratic branch, wasn't supposed to be elected. It was supposed to be at a very high level of debate, but having comedians and politicians in there was about the last thing it was supposed to have. But the worst was, of course, the people who follow them. The stupidity with the more numerous multitude not only become their dupes, but even love to be taken in by their tricks. This sounds very modern, but John Adams is writing this many centuries ago. Having absolutely no idea about this, the ignorant will talk about the Founding Fathers as if they believed in somehow concept of individual rights, which they did not. Rights were never abstract. They didn't refer to everybody. And even if they did, they didn't refer to everybody in all situations. The whole point of the Constitution was to create the aristocratic, what really was to empower the roughly 3 or 4% who were free enough to be able to vote. To be free at the time was to be not poor, not wealthy. To be literate, which meant knowledgeable in Greek and Roman history and languages. To know history very well, to be able to take examples from it, to know the ancient world very well, know the history of philosophy well, but to have economic freedom to the point where they're not dependent on someone else for their money, for their influence, for anything. Those people and those people alone are free, which of course is true. If you're dependent on someone else for your income, you ain't free, which means only a tiny handful of people at any given time are legitimately free, and this is true. Otherwise, you're dependent. Dependency and freedom are two different things. They're opposite things. The point of the Constitution was to take even that 3 or 4% and to set them at odds with one another. So Rossiter continues in his pomposity. He says, and this is, again, why these guys shouldn't be writing history of whatever he thinks, feels he's writing in. He says, the ethical core of individualism assumes the right as well as the duty of the individual to make himself and his pursuit of happiness a top priority in his life, subject to any commitments, loving, charitable, or otherwise, he may freely make to persons other than himself. But if he is an ethical person in his own right, his pursuit of happiness will, as Adam Smith observed, almost always benefit others, though his efforts be expended for his own gain. This man has never read Adam Smith in his life. The Wright brothers' passionate quest for human flight, for example, was surely motivated by the pursuit of personal happiness, not by devotion to others. I don't know how he knows this, but the benefits to the world of their passion have long been incalculable. In a rational society of rational persons, the individual pursuit of his own satisfaction regularly procures goods, services, and relationships that are beneficial to many others, as if this is something new. The innate compatibility of long-term individual interests and long-term social interests is evident in everyday life. He gives us no examples other than, of course, the Wright brothers. Well, even if he had a point with that particular example, all he's doing is he's taking the most extraordinary examples and claiming that this is the norm, having no idea, of course, what a real individual is. As John Adams' own the Founding Fathers say, that they are conformists, they're slavish, they're ignorant, they exist for their own personal gain and nothing more. And that is not rational. He uses words, I don't know why he keeps using words like passion here. He doesn't know what that word means either. Passion doesn't mean enthusiasm. It means being subject to drives you have no control over. But I don't think he knows that. But he makes reference to the Wright brothers. Well, showing you how incompetent he is. For one thing, they used and cited dozens of other inventors before them. Alphonse Pernod, for example, who did the work that they built upon. The Wright brothers were from a wealthy family. They were from the Vanderbilts. They were wealthy, and they used it to fund their work. In fact, most of them in this field were wealthy. Adder, Maxim, Alberto Santos Dumont were all very wealthy men. These weren't just abstract individuals. These were very powerful people who dominated others. But the individualist, referring to them as just like everybody else, mystifies this. I mean, there were many. If he's going to use this one example, I mean, their land was given to them for free in Huffman Prairie near Dayton. The elite capitalists like J.E. Capper from the Royal Balloon Factory began to finance their work. But even beyond that, the physics that they had to master is not their own creation. Everything around them comes from money, comes from power, comes from them not being just an abstract individual. Using the Wright brothers is a terrible example, but he can't find any others because they're all like this. Because he's never actually read Adam Smith, he doesn't realize that Adam Smith, too, saw most individuals as completely irrational. And as always, he's not referring to everybody. He's referring to a small group of people. The pseudo-Aristoi that Adams were talking about is exactly the sort of people that the Vanderbilts are an example of. But beyond this, he's referring to moral virtues as if they just appear in our conscience. They're the result of the communal will, not the individual will. In this simplistic view of the world, there's no reason to act rationally. He even goes so far as to say this. This is how dumb this man is. He says that liberalism has undermined the sanctity of marriage and the cohesiveness of the family. It's disconnected the rewards of merit and desert. And get this, he says, it's corrupted the moral and ethical basis for civilized living. It's polarized the population into warring classes with false claims of victimization and villainy and contrived needs for political rescue. Where does a moral and ethical basis come from in among abstract individuals functioning entirely by utility, as Adam Smith had advocated? And where did the sanctity of marriage come from? That's the very negation of individualism. It's a complete destruction of the individual. So what is he talking about? And sanctity? Where does sanctity come from, if it's nothing more than individuals pursuing utility? In his shocking ignorance, he has no idea that none of these can come from the individual. These are communal properties. But he admits all this, destroying his own argument, having no idea that he's destroyed his own, by saying this, that somehow liberalism, which is apparently different from him, quote, has undermined the natural harmony that exists between individual, family, and community. It's weakened the obligations of promise, contracts, ownership, and property rights. Now, he just admitted that he's full of it. Natural harmony that exists between individual, family, and community. He just denied that those things exist. Only the individual matters. Where is this harmony from? And how is it natural? And if it's natural, then it's not individual. Then, of course, the next sentence, obligations of contracts, ownership, and property rights, proving the point that all of this is really just about commercial interests anyway. He undermines his own argument, and he's so dumb he doesn't even realize it. I mean, at the most, he thinks that maybe no one will notice. But this is why psychiatrists, really anyone else, shouldn't. In fact, most historians shouldn't write history. Most psychiatrists shouldn't write about psychiatry. What is this guy talking about? He uses the most simplistic terms. He thinks he knows what they mean. And he talks about moral norms as if they're an individual creation. We all didn't come up with the sanctity of marriage independently of each other. But that's what he implies. I think what he doesn't realize he's claiming is the individual notion of liberalism from industrialization, and then the liberalism of the 20th century, like FDR's New Deal and the lifestyle liberalism and Lyndon Johnson, etc. But what he thinks conservatism is a revolutionary enlightenment doctrine that, in fact, conservatism was created to oppose. But individualism, in the vulgar way that he describes it, is a 20th century creation. It had no currency in the past. In fact, even the most liberal of the founding fathers, like Thomas Jefferson, excoriated the notion. Having had no idea, and these men have no idea that these men despised it. They were talking about the legitimate aristocracy of those who have the wisdom and the knowledge to extract a truth from historical studies, usually in Greek and Latin. That was the very definition of literacy. But Hayek, as we noticed before, mentions Edmund Burke. Edmund Burke is one of these guys that conservatives will refer to, but don't understand, and have never read. Because the minute they do, they realize that all of this individual nonsense falls apart. Burke talks about liberty, not the reward of our merit, or the acquisition of industry, it's our inheritance, he said, the birthright of our species. He says we cannot forfeit our right to it, but by what forfeits our title to the privileges of our kind, the abuse, oblivion of our rational faculties, the ferocious indocility which makes us prompt to wrong and violence, destroys our social nature, and transforms us into something little better than the description of wild beasts. Now, of course, in previous definitions of individualism, there's no reason not to be a wild beast. Because if you give me a reason why, you're appealing to something that's not individual. So Burke says, to men so degraded, a state of strong constraint is a sort necessary. It's a necessary substitute for freedom, since bad as it is, it may deliver them in some measure from the worst of all slavery. That is, a despotism of their own blind and brutal passions. Then he's talking about what he thinks this really means. And he says, it is not solitary, unconnected, individual, selfish liberty, as if every man was to regulate the whole of his conduct by his own will. The liberty, I mean, social freedom. That state of things which liberty is secured by the equality of restraint. The moment will is set above reason and justice, in any community, a great question may arise in sober minds, in what part or portion of the community that dangerous dominion of the will may be at least mischievously placed. And this is from his letter to Dupont in November of 1789. And the argument, of course, couldn't be any more anti-individual. Individualist, I should say. By adhering to those principles of our forefathers, we are guided not by the superstitions of antiquarians. He attacks liberals of the time. And by the way, antiquarianism were the philosophers who promoted the Enlightenment, by the way. But then he supports the traditional norms. So the same plan of conformity to our nature and our artificial institutions, we've derived several benefits from considering our liberties in light of our inheritance. Strong institutions, of course, can create stability if the institutions are able to avoid corruption. But, the problem is, with someone like John Adams would say, it's really the same idea, just from a different context. Our Constitution was made only for a moral and religious people. It is wholly inadequate to the government of any other. Democracy never lasts long. It soon wastes, exhausts, and murders itself. There was never a democracy that did not commit suicide. And that was John Adams' letter to John Taylor, late 1814. Then he says, human passions unbridled by morality and religion would break the strongest cords of our Constitution as a whale goes through a net. This, of course, would be new to psychiatrists who want to pretend that they have some knowledge in this area. None of these men, only until the postmodern age, believed that there was an abstract individual, that this was nothing other than a revolutionary doctrine that had a purely commercial basis, that purely was a negative. That is to say, it was meant to destroy the old social obligations for the sake of building a purely oligarchic commercial state, which is what a republic is. As I've said many times before, Karl Marx, who none of these guys have ever read either, realized how indebted he was to capitalism and free trade precisely for this reason, that if it did not destroy the old social obligation, the family and everything else, he would have no way to build. You can't have an internationalist revolution or an international working class unless you've destroyed nations, unless you've destroyed the guild, unless you've destroyed all of these other forms of obligation and interaction. But that's what capitalism does. That's the point of it. The point of capitalism is to destroy communal institutions, liberate the individual, and then it becomes collectivized. A collectivization is not the same thing as a community. In fact, they're opposites. A person comes from a community. The individual is forced into the collective. Those are two completely different things. And really, we're talking not really about individuals, we're talking about masses. A mass is not a thing. It's certainly not rational. And one of the central ideas about the mass of people rather than actually citizens are only, there's only a handful of actual citizens anywhere, but the mass is very easily manipulated. As we well know, this is not really rational. They're not really humans. It's just as these people unknowingly say, they're ruled by passion, and they have by definition, no control over passions. Word patient, like doctor and patient. Patient comes from the word passion. They're dominated by others. They have no control over what's happening to them. And people use words like passion to refer to enthusiasm. That's not what the word means. It refers to the control that our drives have over us. Sometimes even everything from anger to sex to greed to money to everything else. Usually one form or another. Domination. They'll actually point to Edmund Burke, having no idea what he said. You know, I read this quote from him, and very few of them, including the intellectuals, have any idea what he means. The point of it all, whether it be Hegel or John Adams or Thomas Jefferson, even though they were opposed in various ways, though it was means rather than end. Edmund Burke, even Friedrich Hayek, all understood the overwhelming majority of the population to be ignorant, to be irrational. Reason is hard. It's a lot of work. Being logical, People use the phrase thinking for yourself, not realizing this is a lifelong effort that comes only from very intense expertise. Then maybe you could have some very tentative approach to the topic. And even there, you're very dependent on lots of other people for its development. You know, I go back to his ignorant using of the Wright brothers. And I've heard them before as a, you know, an example of individualism, and every single aspect of their achievement, for better or for worse, was based on other people, because it all is. Even the notion of someone dope like him talking about individualism, that came from his own experience. It comes from some ethical interests that he has, having no clue as a psychiatrist, having no idea where ethical norms come from, having no idea where the sanctity of marriage comes from, as if this is somehow a matter of contract. And he admits, as I said, he admits that this is really all about commerce anyway, and even goes so far as to undermine his entire argument, hopefully that no one will notice. Edmund Burke and George William Frederick Hegel are the most, Hegel is the most rational of them all. Because as I began this talk about Hegel's civil society and abstract, so-called abstract, infinite freedom, as you infinite rights, meaning solely self-interested action for no great end other than your own personal interest. That, of course, can't last. Adams said that, you know, that kind of democracy will destroy itself. Democracy is a mass. It's mass rule. It's meaningless. It's a herd of people that gets, you know, things like media and PR firms to tell them what to believe, which is what the mass is. To use a word like mass, you're not talking about people anymore. You're talking about animals. You're talking about a herd. And at least in this field, that's what most people are. They refer to an abstraction like individual, and they think of themselves. Or they think of those, you know, in their day-to-day life, having no idea what actual individuals really are. And they end up importing these communal products like marriage and the cohesiveness of the family, as if this somehow comes from Adam Smith's utilitarian contractarianism. And of course, the man has not read any of these guys. But it is a vague grasp of an ideology that they radically oversimplify, because then it sounds good. And hopefully, God help the people who go to him for psychiatric care. God knows what he says to them. Holy cow. You know, he's probably a good argument for psychotropic medication. That's pretty much all he has to offer. The distortion, how the distorted view he has of the human psyche, that somehow all this stuff comes automatically and through contract. Just don't ask him where the concepts came from prior to the contract, or what happened before the contract at all. And of course, I'm sure the guy doesn't know what utilitarianism is. But and then has the goal to say that the balance of community, family, and individual, undermining his entire argument. And of course, there's a very famous book, The Liberal Mind, which was a book for the neocons. And as a psychiatrist, somehow he got away with writing this stupid thing. But this is the nature of modern libertarianism and republicanism. Edmund Burke, that I've been studying my entire adult life, and really Hegel, Plato, and Burke, Nietzsche, outside of course the medievals, which is a separate group of people altogether for me, I've been studying since I was 17. And as a 17-year-old, I had a far more sophisticated connection and understanding of these guys than the people who are writing and defending the most irrational of all ideologies. Individualism, which of course metaphysically comes from nominalism. It comes from the Protestant Reformation, ultimately. And then that became official and institutionalized, so to speak, during industrialization. And now has become the irrational, animal-like mass in post-modernity. And that's their contribution to the world. At a minimum, my contribution to the world is the ability to make fun of these people and to mock their pretensions to any kind of knowledge whatsoever. Anyway, thank you for listening. I'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye.